Welcome to 100 Things I'll Miss When I'm Dead. I'm Michael Colville Anderson. Welcome to My Happy Place, my podcast where I self-medicate against my constant overthinking and anxiety about my own mortality with tiny happy pills of positivity and reflection. Number 56, being on time. I remember when I was young how I liked to get to places on time, figure out the route, the logistics, arriving perhaps late the first time, but adjusting deftly for the future trips, optimizing journeys, and I still continue to do this today. Like knowing exactly what time I have to leave my apartment to get to Copenhagen Airport at exactly the right time to arrive at the gate for boarding. I have it down to a science, although I regard it more as an art. Airports in other cities are more challenging, but the game never stops. Trains give me more stress. I guess an airport is a controlled space. Once you're past security, it's designed, some way better than others, for the purpose of getting you to the gate. I get irritated when the path forces you through retail shopping zones on meandering routes. But train stations are less structured. So many variables. I usually arrive well early to ensure I find the platform. I've learned that arriving on time varies from culture to culture. In Northern Europe, it's a point of pride. You will literally get texts from people saying, "Sorry, I'm going to be 5 minutes late." Not 15, not 30, 5. I was invited for dinner in Brazil once. 8 o'clock, I was told. So there I was at 8 sharp. My friend opened the door in shorts and with a confused look on his face. He had lived in Europe, so he realized right away what was happening. "Oh, sorry, Michael, 8 means 8 where you're from. In Brazil, it means later than 8. I came in and helped him make dinner, which he had barely started doing. I had questions. What does later than 8 mean? He didn't know. Just later. He tried to help me out by thinking about his culture, but still had nothing specific to offer. People started arriving at around 9:30 or 10. "Why do you say 8 when you mean 10? He didn't know. I grilled the other guests. They thought I was weird for even thinking about it. I know that the timelines are a little bit more blurred in Southern Europe, but this was bizarre. When spending a lot of time in Oslo with an ex who lived there, I had to adapt to her get-there-on-time departure times when we needed to catch a tram a couple of 100 meters from her flat. She left even less time than I would have. So I would be dressed to leave, doing a little impatient dance at the door, and she'd be wandering around with an air of calm, wondering what shoes to wear. I ended up learning to trust her logistics after there was proof of concept with a couple of tram trips. But when I run the show for myself, it is a favorite game. I'll check routes and times well in advance. I'll make a mental note of what time I should leave in order to get there at the required time. In my own city, Copenhagen, I obviously know by heart how long it is to get to places that I frequent, or even just neighborhoods. Okay, so that cafe is 12 minutes away, so add another minute for that other cafe nearby. Once I know how long it will take me, and I leave at the right time, I don't look at my phone to check my progress. If it's a new destination, I'll check when I get there to see how precise I was. Yesterday, I walked 36 minutes to a friend's flat in Paris. I arrived 2 minutes early and did a mental fist bump. And then I waited 2 minutes to ring the bell. Arriving early isn't cool either. On a related note, I don't look at the time much at all during the day, and never at night. If I wake up for some reason, I don't check what time it is. This will cause unnecessary stress about how much sleep I might be losing. One of my observations in my work in urbanism is how people on bikes use the city's clock towers, even in the age of the smartphone. In the intense morning rush hour, I observe people glancing up and then doing one of three things. Keeping the same pace, they're on time. Relaxing in the saddle and slowing down, they're ahead of schedule. Leaning forward and pedaling faster. They're a bit behind schedule, and they will now correct it. If you're more casual about time, don't think it's stressful to go places with me. You can relax. I'll get us there. But let me also say that I'm just as happy to wander aimlessly, without a care in the world for schedules. Summer holidays are a treat. Spending 2 or 3 weeks on a Greek island is timeless. I figure out what zone of the day I'm in by watching the island life and the light and the angle of the shadows. Ah, okay, people are leaving their lounge chairs. It must be lunch o'clock, with variations for the northern Europeans and the southern. Ah, now people are packing up their towels and heading back to their accommodation in the afternoon to shower and get ready for dinner, and so on. A vague clock where the day is divided up according to light and dark and mealtimes and naps, and strangers are the hands on the clock. I like to control time. I'm going to miss that game when I'm dead. But I also like to let go whenever I can. Number 57, giving up control. And with that, oh God, welcome to the no control segment of this episode. Today I'm just going to freestyle and see what the hell comes out of this in editing. I am not at all in a comfortable place right now. I often call myself a perfectionist, but now that I think of it, it's really only in certain areas of my life. Not in the extreme sense of the word, but in a way, it's still enough. I think it's mostly in creative pursuits where I'm the most perfectionistic. And I think I always have been. It's mostly when producing media that I think I have this perfectionist tendency. I like to have control over the creative process from the idea stage, you know, throughout the entire production process to the final product. If I don't have that, then I find that I get a little bit irritated. I don't have a problem giving the control to other people that I trust in my industry, in whatever project I'm working on. But if I don't have that myself the whole way through, then, it kind of bugs me a little bit. I travel all the time with my work, and I post a lot of things on social media. I have a YouTube channel for my TV series, The Life-Size City. And some friends of mine have said, you know, through the years, dude, you're all over the place. You can just pick up your phone and speak into the phone, make a little video and point at stuff in the background and say what works, what doesn't work. And I've thought about that a lot. But every single time, I realize that it won't be perfect. It'll be a phone shot, even though phones have an amazing resolution these days, certainly mine does. But then there's the sound aspect. The sound won't be perfect if I only use the phone microphone. This whole perfectionist thought process really kind of ruins a lot of content for me. I don't think it'll be good enough to please my perfectionist tendencies. I do remember when I was a young man, this perfectionist thing, it kind of started really quite early. Back in the day, I would be sending out applications for a bartender or applying to a theater school or whatever I needed to do that involved printing something on a piece of paper and sending it to somebody. I haven't done that for a while, but you remember that, right? Letters on paper, in envelopes, stamps, addresses, and you put it in a box and it magically appears in another place. Even when I was in my late teens, I thought, I need an extra edge on all of these applications. So I would go down and I would buy really nice paper at a stationery store. Good quality paper, not just the normal stuff that everybody had lying around. Paper that when you touched it felt just a little bit different. You could feel the quality. And I already thought back then that if I have that little tiny edge, that subconscious edge that the person reading this letter is touching this very nice paper, then that has got to be a good thing. Every little bit counts. In a way, that's a creative thought process, designing the kind of paper that I would send applications on. Even though I had no control over the outcome, whether I would get the job, whether I would get into that school, I was trying to control as much of the design process as possible. Now, like I said, I'm not really in a comfortable space at the moment, so let me explain the usual process when doing this podcast, which might also explain why I'm a bit loose with publishing it. First of all, of course, I think about it. I make a list of these 100 things I'll miss when I'm dead. I write notes about different topics. Then, I choose a topic and I write a script about it. After that, when I'm satisfied with the result, I will practice reading it, probably 3, 4, sometimes 5 times, just to get the feel of it. Then I go into my bedroom and I record it in a little sound studio that I have, which is basically a cheap IKEA cupboard that I bought and converted. That's where I'm speaking to you from right now. And then I edit, and I polish, and I publish. I'll also admit that I've already failed in this freestyle podcasting exercise that I've embarked on. I was going to lie on the sofa in my living room with a little lapel mic that I have that I use to record podcasts when I'm outdoors interviewing people for mostly the Life Size City podcast. And I tested it last night, but I have a very minimalistic living room with not a lot of things on the walls and a hardwood floor. So the echoey sound already then was irritating me. And I thought I would just do that and then explain it to you guys and everything would be fine. It's all part of the experiment. But I failed. So I'm standing in my little IKEA hacked sound studio. It was a difficult decision to make this segment without a script. I can talk, sure. Anybody who knows me knows that to be true. There's no hurdle there. But just to use some rough notes on my phone and then speak into the microphone without any predetermined structure or any kind of storytelling or dramaturgy, it feels really quite odd. My friend here in Copenhagen, Rachel, said that I should just record and upload without any editing at all. That is not going to happen. But I have, of course, been thinking about this topic. And like I said, I've realized through that process that it's mostly in my creative pursuits that I am a perfectionist. In most aspects of my life, I just, you know, kind of go with the flow. I try to live in the now. I love spontaneity. Like a Friday night that has no structure and just ends up going somewhere with whoever joins me is the best kind of Friday night ever. That spontaneity, as well as a busy travel schedule, makes it difficult to pin me down for social events. I don't like knowing what I'm doing next week. I'm speaking to you today on a Thursday night. I'm probably going to go out. I'll probably go out Friday and Saturday. Next week, nobody knows what's going to happen, and I certainly do not want to know at all. This is also tricky in a country like Denmark, where calendars, you know, amongst my friends, are booked often 3 weeks in advance. For me, it's kind of odd to know that in 3 weeks' time, I'll be having dinner at a predetermined address at a predetermined time with some friends. It happens in my life, not very often, but it still just feels kind of weird. It's like I'm locked into something in the future that might stand in the way of other possibilities. Here in my apartment, I try to keep it cool and minimal. Otherwise, the Danish design police will probably come knocking on the door. But I can still be messy. There is, for example, a huge pile of dirty clothes on the floor of my bedroom. Actually, I think some of them are still clean. I could probably pick them out and put them on if I needed to. I am never going to get past that one at all. I've given up all hope. There is a structured kind of creative chaos and mess on my desk. To other people, it might look completely confusing, but I know absolutely where everything is. Once in a while, I love just leaving the dishes in the sink and watching them pile up because I can. Later on, there is also a kind of satisfaction when I stand there for half an hour and do all the washing up. When I make art, which is something I think I mentioned in a previous episode, it is a creative process, but I strangely just go with the flow and reject too much control. I unthink. Unthinking is a really interesting concept and area of research if you Google it. So thinking about this now, standing here, I guess I've divided my life up into controlled areas and happily uncontrolled areas, finely manicured lawns and wild patches of natural foliage. And as an urbanist, I think I'm obliged to tell you that lawns are absolutely ridiculous. Wild, crazy foliage is way better for any local environment. You can Google why lawns are bad and figure out more about that. I can attempt to control the wild areas once in a while. I pick up the clothes off the floor and I clean up my bedroom, but it lasts for about a week or so. Still feels good in that little period of time. Just as good as it feels when I go back to the norm. But giving up control of the controlled areas is anxiety provoking. Like this segment of the podcast. I think I need a drink. Number 58, wine. Did you hear how I said wine? Because wine is absolutely awesome. I think it was about, 15 years ago where I stopped drinking beer. Not forever. Once in a while, on a hot summer's day, a cold beer is awesome. But I stopped drinking it when I was going out with friends, at a bar, at a restaurant. Like everybody else, I got used to the bloated feeling from drinking too much beer. But for me, it was simply a question of having to pee all the time. Constantly. when I drink beer, I have to go to the bathroom. And I felt that this had a negative impact on the conversations I was having with people when I was out. I've always liked wine as well, so that became my go-to drink. But here's the thing. I don't know too much about wine at all, and I simply don't want to. I am demonstrative in my quest not to know too much about wine. I don't want to be a wine nerd. I don't want to be any kind of nerd, really. I don't like having to taste the wine and smell it and go through all of those motions when it's poured into the glass. Ah, yes, fruity and yet subtly precocious, with notes of earthy confidence, you know, all of that language used to describe wine, I simply don't want to be a part of it. I had a sommelier friend who told me years ago that if you really want to impress a sommelier or somebody who knows wine at a restaurant like the server, all you do is smell the wine. Make sure that it smells okay. Tasting it, washing it around your mouth, sucking it through your lips, you know, to really savor the whole bouquet and everything like that. It's simply unnecessary. You look like a bit of a badass if all you do is smell the wine and nod to the server. I've done that for many years, and it works. Like with so many other aspects of life, fake it till you make it. Generally, I am happy to piggyback on other people's knowledge. If I'm at a restaurant and there's a whole bunch of wines and I'm with some people who like wines, I'm totally going to trust them to pick something that I will enjoy. I have some prerequisites. I don't know why, but I like Italian wine. French as well, but mostly Italian. And something light that day, maybe something a little bit heavier another day. I can describe what kind of wine I want, but I have no idea where that wine might come from, which region, which appellation, well, you know, everything like that. There are many good reasons why you choose a local bar to hang out at. And my local wine bar, they understand me. They find me a wine I like, and I stick to it. I can't tell you at all what I'm drinking. It tastes good. That's it. I usually remember the graphic design on the bottles. Hey, you know, I'll have the one with that little pink M, or the one with that light blue, you know, label with the kind of the cursive text on it. That's how I order wine. The staff at my local wine bar, they've been spotted asking each other, hey, has Michael tried this one? No, but he won't like it. Or, yeah, I think he'll like that one. They know exactly what I need. That's why you have a local bar. Over the past few years, I've developed two seasons. If you see me drinking rosé into the autumn, and then the next day I'm drinking red wine, you know that winter is coming. But the opposite is true in the spring. At some point, I decide, you know what? It's time to go back to the rosé for the duration of the summer. I'm basically your wine-drinking weather report. So, yeah, I'm not a purist. Therefore, I dig the disruption of New World wineries mixing up the grapes and irritating the Europeans. I don't dig the slang, though, mostly in America, where they shorten the names of the kinds of wines. Four times, documented, I've ordered Cabernet Sauvignon in the States, and the server is like, I'm sorry, what? And I point at the menu, and they say, oh, Cab Sav. Ow. And I'm like, yeah, that's the short version of Cabernet Sauvignon. And every single time, it's like, oh, really? I didn't know that. If you're going to slang it up, at least know the origin of the words. For reasons I cannot control, my friends are wine nerds. They have a little wine club, and they meet up once a month, and they try all these new wines, and they challenge each other, and they taste them, and they go through all of the motions. I get it. It is a social event with people who share a common interest. I am happily never invited. But when me and the boys have a dinner, everybody brings a bottle of wine, and we wrap it up so you can't see the label. And with each bottle, we go through the motions. Well, not we, obviously, I am not involved in this at all. And they all try to taste the wine and guess the country and the region and the grape and all of that stuff. Although I will admit it is fun to watch and see how they go through these motions and who gets it right and who doesn't, who knows the most about wine. It's an interesting, well, not that interesting, but a little bit interesting spectator sport. So at these dinners, I have to bring a bottle of wine, and I have a local wine shop. 50 meters from my home, super cool guy. He opened up a couple of years ago. I go in there and say, hey, I got a dinner with my friends again, so find me a bottle of wine that they will never guess, which will completely mess up their egos about knowing so much about wine. And my guy at the wine shop, He loves it. Every time I come in, he gives me some bizarre wine from some remote region of Sardinia or Catalonia. And sure enough, the boys never get close to guessing what it is. I can't win at their game, so I make my own game where I am the champion. Ironically, I know more about whiskey. That's only because a friend's dad caught me when I was young and impressionable and taught me a whole bunch about it. Generally, I like the whole storytelling aspect of whiskey, wine, mezcal, rum, all the history, all the process that goes into it. I just don't want to know too much about the actual liquid itself. Here in my notes, I had already chucked in a few quotes about wine. Here's one. Wine is one of the most civilized things in the world, and one of the most natural things of the world that has been brought to the greatest perfection. And it offers a greater range for enjoyment and appreciation than possibly any other purely sensory thing. Ernest Hemingway. Wine can be a better teacher than ink, and banter is often better than books. The one and only Stephen Fry. One should always be drunk. That's all that matters. But with what? With wine, with poetry, or with virtue, as you choose. But get drunk. Charles Baudelaire. And here's one for the ages, from Rumi, the 13th century Persian poet. Either give me more wine, or leave me alone. I'll leave you with a fun fact from the Nordic countries. Wine importers from the south, France, Spain, Italy, when they send wine to the north, they make sure that it has a higher alcohol percentage. I have an incredibly hard time trying to find bottles of wine at supermarkets in Denmark that are only 12%. Incredibly easy in a French supermarket, for example. But there is this cultural difference here in the north. We're more used to drinking hard alcohol. So all of these wine producers know this, and they make sure to age the wine a little bit more to make it a little bit stronger. So your normal percentage for a bottle of wine that you buy in a supermarket here in Denmark and the rest of the Nordic countries is, 13, 14, 15%. You can find exactly the same bottle of wine from the same producer in Denmark, and it's 15%. You go to a French supermarket, and that wine is only 12%. There you go. Don't know anything about wine, but I got some fun facts. Number 59, making food. I was kind of on the fence about this one. It took me a bit of time to finally decide to add it to this list. Because for most of my life, my baseline has been, I am creative all day long. And the last thing I want to do is have to stand in a kitchen and be creative when I'm technically done work. I just never like the going through the motions of I have to feed myself and prepare food in order to survive. Once in a while, throughout my life, I will engage in a spectacular culinary event and use hours creating some really cool dish. But that's when I'm in the mood to be creative. I've also always found it irritating to have to make food for myself when nobody else is home. Going through the process of spending 30 minutes, 60 minutes making food only to feed myself, I just never really understood that at all. Not only for myself, but also for, on occasion, ungrateful children. It just seems like, to me, a complete waste of time. Quite often, if I'm in a period where I am home alone and the kids are at their mom's, I will make a large portion of something, of chili, of some vegetable curry, whatever, and I will eat it for several days in a row. Then, along came a global pandemic. And, like so many people around the world, I realized that there wasn't much else to do. So, I'm going to experiment with recipes. So I've spent a lot of time over the past year and a half really kind of expanding my skill set in making food. A lot of the food I was making was Asian. Indian curries, Thai curries, you name it. Putting a podcast on my phone, standing in the kitchen for an hour and a half, sometimes 2 hours, taking my time to prepare the food, tasting it, adding some spices. That whole process was incredibly rewarding. Not many good things came out of the COVID pandemic, but this is certainly one of them. I don't think I rediscovered the joy of preparing food or even discovered it for the first time. I just think I understood, because I was given the time and space, the aesthetics of preparing cuisine. And at some point during the pandemic, I think I had a thought like, wow, Making food actually is incredibly primal. It's timeless. It's universal. It's the one thing humans all have to do to survive. And in that weird void that was the COVID pandemic, it was also a way to continue to be creative in a different way, because many other options were not available to me. So it filled a gap in my creative life. One of the interesting things about living in Denmark is that not many people that I know have a microwave. It is a standard piece of equipment in other cultures, but not so much here. At some point, I was asking around, you know, asking my friends, saying, hey, do you have a microwave? And only a small percentage of them did. And all of them who had one only used it to defrost meat from the freezer. I kind of like that about this culture. You have to stand in the kitchen and prepare food on a stove. Even if you buy a ready-made meal from the supermarket, you still have to put it on a frying pan or in a pot and use the time required to warm it up. Back when I was married, my ex-wife and I, we got really tired at some point in our relationship about texting each other every single day going, hey, what do you want for dinner? I don't know. Do you want to make dinner tonight? I made it last night. Oh, I don't want to make it. I have to work late. And this whole discussion back and forth almost every single day, who was going to go to the supermarket, who was going to make the dinner, and what should we eat? It just kind of got on our nerves. So we had a tip from another couple, some friends of ours, and they had simply divided up their lives in the kitchen into food weeks. And my ex-wife and I, we heard about this, and we kind of laughed, going, oh, do we need this kind of structure? Seems like something you're going to read in Cosmopolitan magazine or something. And we kind of made fun of it. And then we said, hey, why don't we just try it? So we did. It was a massive success. Starting on a Monday, it was my food week. I decided what we were going to eat for the next 7 days. I went to the supermarket to acquire the ingredients. And then the next Monday, I had nothing to do with it at all. It was my ex-wife's turn to take the seven-day journey into the kitchen and figure out what we were going to eat. We noticed early on that we had a lot of go-to recipes, things that we just made because they're easy and quick and everybody liked them. So then we implemented a new rule in the Food Week program that at least twice a week you had to make something that you had never tried before. That made it even more interesting. So if you're in a similar situation with anybody else at all, I can highly recommend it, dividing the life in the kitchen up into food weeks. And that, my friends, concludes the No Control podcast experiment. Full disclosure, I actually recorded three other things that I'll miss when I'm dead using this freestyle format, just babbling into the microphone without structure, without direction. And I'm sitting here editing the podcast now, and it is driving me absolutely crazy. When editing, it's quite a time-consuming process. You have all of the speech on the line in the editing program, and I go in between all the gaps where nothing's being said, and I remove it. So it's kind of like this dead space. It makes it sound way better and much more professional when you do that. And I've been trying to be a little bit loose in the editing, not really doing that, so you can hear maybe a different sound quality, and that sound quality is just driving me bananas. So I decided to stop here. It's about a half an hour episode, so I'm going to pick up where I left off in the next episodes and continue in the way that I've been doing it for a long time, putting a little bit more elbow grease into it, spending a little more time editing and also preparing a script and doing it the way I've been doing it from the beginning. It was a fun experiment, completely anxiety-provoking as well, but it was really nice to try and give up control and actually publish an episode of the podcast in this style. Those friends of mine who listen to this podcast and who know me on social media, send me a message and tell me what you think about the two different kinds of podcast production. I'm curious to hear what you think. From a cloudy Sunday in Copenhagen, Michael is out. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to 100 Things I'll Miss When I'm Dead. I'm Michael Koble Anderson. Thanks for being out there.